So, again, thanks for coming.
If everyone would like, if you want to move your chairs up and close
the I'm completely unarmed.
Can I go in here? Or do you crank up the one?
Is that okay?
Yep.
Okay.
How many of you have heard of Vedanta? How many of you have heard of Philadelphia? Okay, what we're going to do is, I want to give sort of a survey or an outline, which hopefully will not be as boring as that just sounded, of different approaches to transcendence and explain where we fit in. Of course, obviously, we're going to be the heroes at the end. But the idea here is that all the spiritual paths we could talk about, if we want to talk about what is roughly called Eastern spirituality, perhaps the three most prominent traditions that I think by far have had the most influence are, on one end you could say certain forms of Buddhism, which also came from India. They're all from India. And the second one you could say is Shankara, Adi Shankara, who probably the single most famous theologian philosopher in Indian history, and basically the it's all one guy. You know, it's all one, and I am God and you are God, that is that one. And he lived about approximately 1,200 years ago. And then finally, in representing Krishna consciousness, there is a very important tradition in India, probably represents more people in traditional in Indian history than any other single tradition. And that is the Vaishnava tradition. So now all these traditions and many others begin from a premise. They start from the premise that our ordinary workaday consciousness, just the ordinary, you know, the ordinary state of consciousness that people in general are in, is not the highest state of consciousness that you could be in. Because if everyone was just sort of born and just by playing at school and getting a job, you were enlightened, then there wouldn't be any paths because everyone would already be there. So the premise is that human beings have tremendous spiritual potential. And through a disciplined practice and through learning wisdom from experienced, realized souls, it is possible, in fact, to very significantly expand and enhance and improve our consciousness with eternal benefits in many cases. So that's the premise. And, of course, obviously, this is also the premise of people we haven't mentioned. I mean, all the major world religions, in a sense, I mean, at least in the philosophical wings of these religions, not simply that's the basic idea. So, in the Middle East, religions, the three great religions that came out of the Middle East, they tend to talk about good and evil. Whereas in Asia, I think the discussion was a little more about knowledge and illusion. About knowledge and illusion. So that the problem is not merely is not at all something like a devil, but the problem really is simply ignorance, and so we have to get knowledge. This actually, anyway, I don't want to go too much into this, the Gnosticism in the Greco-Roman world, but there are many people, even in the classical world, that felt that what we really need is knowledge. Greek word gnosis, Sanskrit jnana, same word. So now, if you understand in some way or other that this ordinary physical world is somehow or other an illusion, what do you do with it? It's like, for example, right now we are persons. Every one of us is an individual person. We have free will. We have feelings. We have thoughts. So what happens to us? When we become enlightened, are we still persons? And what happens to the world? And so I want to sort of run through the different approaches to this. And of course, also, this has a lot to do with what you think the goal is I think practically in every one of these traditions, there is the sense that you have to go back to your roots. That ultimately we have to go forward in the sense of making spiritual progress, but that going forward ultimately takes us back to where, to our origins, our roots, in a very profound sense of the term. Our roots as living beings, as conscious things. And so clearly, what a particular tradition thinks God is, or the highest truth, however they define that, even if they don't sort of traffic in the G word, you know, whatever you think is ultimately the highest, and then that has a lot to do with what you think we are, because if we come from something personal, then we are personal. If we come from something impersonal, then we ultimately are impersonal, because we're going back to that divine source. So I want to talk about the different approaches, and I'm going to argue philosophically, not dogmatically. I'm not going to argue that what I represent has just a more true doctrine or the true revelation as opposed to the false revelations. I'm not going to get into that. I want to reason my way to a conclusion. And this is very common if you know the history of India, the intellectual history of India, because in India they very seldom had religious wars. And so therefore, let's say, discussing or reasoning or arguing for a particular position, really was never stigmatized in India as it was in the West. I mean, just very briefly, and then I want to get on to the actual positions that different traditions took. If you know the famous theory of Hegel, that history tends to move forward dialectically, like there's a thesis, which just means the way things are now, status quo, and then something opposes it, and there's a conflict, and out of that conflict comes a new thing, a synthesis, which is the result of this conflict. And so, also I'd like to add to this post-traumatic stress disorder, which is, it means that someone suffered a traumatic experience. Typical traumatic experiences are soldiers in combat, let's say children or even adults experience some very violent or tragic event. And so post-traumatic, after the trauma is finished, there's still anxiety and stress, like a combat veteran hears a car backfire and dies for cover. So because the nervous system became so stressed by that traumatic event, that it becomes hypervigilant. You know, there's a fear that trauma may reoccur. So one becomes what's called hypervigilant, and they're essentially withdraw from any situation which even subtly or indirectly looks like it could go there again. Anyway, the reason I bring this up is because I think it is absolutely irrefutable, undeniable, that the religious history of Western civilization is traumatic. I mean, the atrocities, the brutality, we don't have to go into all the details here because some of you may still have another meal today. But it's, I mean, as bad as you think it was worse. So the history of religion, and especially the history of, let's say, of what happened when there was more than one, because as long as everybody agreed that there's only one religious authority, there was a type of peace. But as soon as there was another idea, it got very nasty. So the history, the religious history of our civilization is undeniably traumatic up till very recently. It was certainly traumatic, practically up to even the 19th century in America. You know about the massacre of Mormons and things like that. So you could say liberal or learned Western civilization has become hyper-vigilant against anything which sounds like someone saying that one religion is better than another. And so it's gone to the other extreme. This is like the antithesis. So after this traumatic history, it's gone to the opposite extreme, where it's just not done. It's impolite and just sort of ignorant and unenlightened. It should in any way imply that one thing might be better than something else, because everything, you know, whatever works for you, et cetera, et cetera. You probably know all the slogans because you're close enough to California. So the idea here is that what I've been trying to explain in my talks, or trying to persuade people, is that we have to move to a synthesis, we have to move on historically. And among people who are not going to kill each other, who are inclusive, who respect each other, we can actually talk about these things without being unenlightened. In fact, it's a healthy thing sometimes to talk seriously about what is reasonable, about what is not reasonable in spirituality among people who are not, going to go to war over it. So, having said that, I'll read one Sanskrit verse in the Bhagavad Gita, and then launch into my diatribe. So, Krishna, in chapter 10, text 8 of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, Aham sarvasya prabhavo matak sarvam pravartate iti matva vajante mang buddha bhava samanvita. I am the source of everything. That's what it literally means. I am the source of everything. Everything emanates from me. Considering this, iti matva, it's the verb man, which like the word mind, it's cognate, the English word mind, Sanskrit manas. So matva is the verb, thus being mindful of, in a sense, or thus being aware of. Being aware of this, buddha, the word buddha means, they're the same root as the word buddha, the awakened one or enlightened one. Buddha simply means intelligent people. Intelligent people being mindful of this fact that I'm the source of everything, that everything emanates from me, bhajante mam, which it can be translated worship me, but it's a very complex word, worship me Bhava Samanvita, with all of their existence. They devote their existence to me knowing this. So the reason I read this verse in the Bhagavad Gita is because it's a verse about origins. And if you've ever heard of Vedanta, the Vedanta traditions of India, and that was the major leagues of Indian philosophical tradition. There was, just very briefly, in India, it has a very powerful intellectual tradition, which was really metaphysical. Was almost always metaphysical, concerned with things like the soul and God. And there were six very prominent philosophies in Indian history. And as they continued to debate and argue and influence each other and form, philosophical coalitions and so on and so forth, ultimately what emerged as the gold medalist, the winner, the big winner in this tradition was Vedanta. Vedanta emerged as by far the most powerful philosophical tradition. And the Vedanta begins, the very first statement of the Vedanta is Atato Brahma Jigyasa, which in Sanskrit means that now we should try to understand the absolute truth. So first of all, there's the concept that there is an absolute truth, that there are not merely relative truths. And of course, this is stated in direct as a direct challenge to a certain type of Buddhism, because there are many schools of Buddhism. If you've studied the history of Buddhism, it's extremely diverse, and it's really a whole constellation of traditions. But in any case, there was one sort of very intellectualized Buddhism which became prominent, and the greatest exponent of this was Nagarjuna. And still in India, this Buddhism is still in India. And his position was pratitya samuppada, which means that I take a chair, that chair over there, it's not really a chair. That's the emptiness. That's the shunyata, or the emptiness of Buddhism. They wouldn't deny that something is there, but what's there is just a continually interdependent process, so that we can't point to a single thing, like say, that's a chair, because it's, because the chair exists, because it depends the law of gravity to stay in one place, and this depends on that, and that depends on this. And so they conclude that there really is no thing in the world. There's only all these processes going on. So I would suggest that's taking a very good idea a little too far, in this sense, that Krishna in the Gita also acknowledges that everything in the material world is in process. In fact, the exact words he uses are adibhuta kshara bhava. The governing principle of the material world is that existence is continually in flux. At the same time, Vedanta announces that, but there is an absolute truth. there is an absolute truth. To give a simple example, I mean the simplest example is you and me. Krishna gives this example also in the Bhagavad Gita that, he says, dehi nosmin jitha dehi, and so on, that in this body, all of us have experienced changes of body. We have technically reincarnated many times in this body. Carne, flesh. So we've reincarnated. So, because approximately every 7 years, you replace all the elements of the body, your hair, skin, everything is constantly replacing itself. And so, it's not that our, let's say, infant body just stretched into our present body. It's actually a different body. And so even though we have reincarnated, actually, depending on, how many times you can divide your age by seven, we have reincarnated several times in this lifetime, and we've certainly changed our mind about many things. I don't think any of us think exactly as we did when we were infants or even children. So we're changing our mind, our feelings change, and so on. However, despite these changes of body and mind, there is a person, you, who is the same person. And this is revealed by a very simple analysis of language. We say, I was a baby, I was a child, I changed my mind. I changed my mind. So, it's still you, but you change your mind, you change your body. So, even though so many things have changed, there is still a continuing, permanent person. In fact, when some Buddhists, who in the early days of Buddhism, now talking about, let's say, the first century or two after Buddha, the historical Buddha, this is a very typical thing in the history of religions. And you see it in many different histories of religion, histories of different religions, that the followers of a teacher go beyond their teacher and become even more radical. We could talk about the psychology of this and why this is the case. It was certainly the case with Shankara and also the case with the Buddha. To give one simple example, if you know the basic life of the Buddha, that once he achieved his enlightenment, he was Deer Park near Benares, and he began giving what I guess lectures are often translated sermons, because I guess that comes from the 19th century when they first translated the Pali word. But anyway, so he began giving sermons, and the second sermon, that means teaching number two in the whole history of Buddhism, sermon number two is officially called the Sermon on the Non-Existence of the self. What's fascinating about this sermon, because I read it out loud, actually I've taught a course several times at I was at the University of Florida just because I taught this course on the history of the Indian religion, and I read the sermon because it's not very long. It's no wonder Buddhism became very popular, the lectures were so short. So it's just a few paragraphs. And in this official sermon on the non-existence of the self, what Buddha doesn't say is that the soul doesn't exist. He actually never said that. And that became an embarrassment for some Buddhists, because they were so vigorously preaching that there's no soul, there's no self, because everything is constantly in flux. And what's not known today is that thousands of years ago, in the early days of Buddhism, one of the most prominent schools of Buddhism, it was very powerful, especially in northern India, was a school called the Pudgalavada. Pudgala being the Pali, sort of the Pali word for Purusha, person. And they taught that there is a permanent person. Now, maybe they couldn't use the word soul, because if they did, they wouldn't get invited to Buddhist dinner parties or something. But basically, it meant, rose is a rose is a rose. There is a permanent person. There is a permanent person. And they gave arguments. They said, and this was one of the most prominent Buddhist schools very soon after the historical Buddha. And they said, look, the most popular literature in Buddhism quickly became what are called the Jataka stories. The Jataka stories, Jata in Sanskrit means birth, you're born. So these are stories about the previous lives of the Buddha. And the whole spirit of these stories, which, you know, all the Buddhists read, were that the Buddha was a great soul, and, you know, many lives ago he took birth as a whatever and did all these pious activities, and therefore, because of his sort of extraordinary virtue, he then took birth as this. And they had all things that, of course, Buddha never taught these things, but still, there are all these Jataka stories. And Buddhists also were extremely concerned with karma. Getting good karma, like, what am I going to be in my next life? And what are my ancestors going to be? Because, of course, it came from a culture in which there's a lot of concern with ancestors. And so the Pudgalavadis argue, well, wait a second. I mean, if I do something in this life, and I'm going to get punished or rewarded for it, as all the Buddhists believed, in the next life, but if I'm not a person, what is getting punished and rewarded? And why am I concerned if there is no I? And so they gave all kinds of arguments to say, like, can we have a little common sense around here? Now, what's interesting is that, without going into the whole history of Buddhism, ultimately in Buddhism, with all the different schools and whatever disputes, the big winner here was, of course, the Mahayana tradition, the Great Vehicle tradition. That's the name they sort of modestly gave themselves. And they gave their opponents the Hinayana name, which means it's like the trivial vehicle. But anyway, in Mahayana Buddhism, what emerged as the ideal life, like this is the best thing that you can become through this tradition, was to become a bodhisattva. A bodhisattva, which means something like in Sanskrit, an enlightened being. And the key thing about a bodhisattva is it's a great soul, or a great bodhisattva, who sacrifices or simply turns down his or her own ascension to paradise. There are many Buddhist paradises and heavens and things. And relinquishes that because of this great love and compassion to come back and save the fallen, whatever we're allowed to call them, souls. And so clearly it's a personal thing. A bodhisattva is a person. There are Buddhist gods and goddesses. You know, Avalokiteshvara. There are many gods and goddesses. People pray. They have altars. They have little deities. This is the real Buddhism. The one-hand clapping stuff would never have become a world religion. So the Buddhism that actually became a great world religion was, you could say, sort of old-fashioned religion. And that's interesting. Despite all the different theologies, we study world religions. The religion that really kind of resonates with a lot of people is just sort of this basic idea that here we are now and we have to be enlightened and there are great souls and divine beings who can help us and we can also become divine. There was something called the Buddha Tattu. This is also a very important thing in Mahayana Buddhism. The Buddha Tattu is the Buddha nature. And that means that, and this is, it's indistinguishable from different forms of Vedanta teachings and so on, because Buddhism in India really became, it basically merged back into Hinduism, but they kept their own name and brand. So the Buddha Dhatu, the Buddha nature, means that every one of us originally is an enlightened being. Every one of us is originally an enlightened being. We simply have to revive it. That's exactly what is found in the Krishna literature. The same idea. It is the same idea. So, therefore, going back to Nagarjuna, with all due respect to Nagarjuna, who was, I'm sure he was a really great guy, but if you, let's say, in our zeal, in our enthusiasm to deconstruct the material world and say, don't get caught up, don't get hung up, don't get entangled in the material world because it's just an illusion, it's an illusion, but there are illusions and there are illusions. I mean, to give an example, imagine a still pond and a tree at the side of the pond, and the tree is reflected in the water. So let's say a person, and this is, I mean, you can talk about Plato's cave also, but let's say, to use an outdoor example, let's say you're at the side of the pond and you, for some reason, you only look down, and so you see the tree reflected in the water, and you actually don't know that there's a real tree on the bank. And so for you, that tree in the water is the tree. So, this, by the way, is an example that Krishna gives, sort of a variation on an example Krishna gives in the Gita. So, let's say it's a fruit tree. Let's say it's an apple tree. And you're hungry, and you try to eat the reflected apples. No cigar, or no apple. So, I mean, this... And the other hand, so in one sense, it's an illusion. It's not a real tree. On the other hand, if you look at that reflection, you'll know what a real apple tree looks like. So the reflection of the apple tree is not useless. It's not nothing. Because it gives you a very good picture of what an apple tree is. And so all you have to do is look at the real tree and you're in business. So if you take this world as an illusion, but then the question is it simply, does it tell us nothing about reality? This whole world with the mountains and people and music and love, and it tells us absolutely nothing. It means nothing. It values nothing. It's all, I think this attempt to philosophically annihilate the world, literally, like nihil in Latin means nothing, to nothingate it, or whatever you want to say, to philosophically annihilate the whole universe, I think is a little unhealthy. Because there's a lot of really beautiful things in the world, and there's a lot of beautiful people in the world, and it's not just about trashing everything. And then if you consider yourself, are you real? Are you for real? In the sense that now you're a person, and let's say, you know, you love life. I mean, I'm having a great time, despite everything. So, so we are people. We can fall in love, and other people can love us, and each one of us in our own way is beautiful. And there's just, whether it's our intellectual creations, poetic, musical, nature, crafts, you know, relationships, whatever. What is the status? Is that real? In other words, once you're enlightened, you get to continue being a person. You have to check that in, like give that up. That, like, for example, Shankar would say that once you become enlightened, you just have to give all that up. You don't get to be a free person. All your freedom goes right out the meditational window. No freedom because you're not a person. You're not an individual. You basically merge into a corporate radiance. And, I mean, that's a total no thank you for me. I mean, I love being a person. I love being free and freely doing good things. And I find other free individuals to be sort of infinitely fascinating. And I personally am unwilling to either physically or philosophically, or meditationally, kill myself. To me, meditationally or philosophically committing suicide is not much better than physically committing suicide. It's still very self-destructive. So, but if one thinks that there is no God, then what is the status of your existence? And the Mahayana Buddhism, they've really kind of brought God into the back door. Because it could bring them to the front door because, you know, tradition. But if you look at the descriptions of these great gods and goddesses, I mean, for all practical purposes, these are deities. And they're worshipped as deities, and they are deities. Now, Shankara claims that... anyone remember that song, "When the Moon Hits Your Eye Like a Big Pizza Pie That's Amore"? That song? That's wonderful. To the credit of the American nation that people still know that song. Anyway... So, in a nutshell, Shankara's philosophy is when illusion hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's the world. In other words, there's really only this one, the one. So the idea there's different colors, different notes that form melodies, different individuals. The idea that there is an Ishwar, to use his term, a Lord or God, and or an individual soul, a jiva. All this is illusion. So when Maya, illusion, hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's Ishwara, that's God. And when you... So therefore, you have to give up your freedom, your individuality. There's no colors, there's no sound, there's no music. You know, no one's ever going to ask you to dance, first of all, because there's no you, and second of all, because there's no dances. And so, and you just basically shine forever. And of course, there's a consciousness. The point is that it is in the Bhagavad Gita. And by the way, the Bhagavad Gita, we go through the whole history of India, the great challenge posed by Buddhism and Jainism, the Vedic response to that challenge, how they kind of, you know, reinvented themselves, and the challenges within the Indian, within the Hindu or Vedic tradition. It's a very long history. But suffice it to say, when all the dust cleared, at least in India, and in other places as well, actually, the big winner, the final champion of, I guess you'd call it Vedic idol, like American idol, the big winner was the Bhagavad Gita. The Bhagavad Gita, and that was Gandhi's book, that was Shankara's book. Even Shankara is very well known by scholars to be a closet Vaishnava, a closet Krishna devotee. And he wrote all this very beautiful poetry to Krishna. He really loved Krishna. And he wrote these beautiful poems glorifying Bhagavad Gita. If you go to Jakarta, Indonesia, in the center of Jakarta is a big, like a statue of Krishna and Arjuna on the chariot from the Bhagavad Gita. So the Bhagavad Gita was by far the single most important book. And in the Bhagavad Gita, we find that you are real, that colors and sound, beauty, love, all these things are real. All we have to do is purify them. And, you know, it's like water. Let's say water is contaminated. If you purify it, the real water is still there. You can again have pure, crystalline water if you just remove the contamination. So if we simply remove everything that is not really us, what's left is a divine being. And that divine being is part of God. So again, the fact that we fall in love in this world, the fact that we find beauty in this world, even though it's a reflection, it's still giving us valuable information about the eternal world. This, by the way, is also, in a sense, Plato's philosophy. If you know your Plato and Neoplatonism. So everything's real if we just look up at the object which has created the reflection. And so we don't have to trash the world. We don't have to, you know, kill ourselves philosophically or meditationally. And we can be in love forever. It's a great thing. Now the chanting, one last point, and then the chanting, okay, very briefly, if you study world religions, as you can see, I've got this world religion mania, but if you study world religions, what you find is that virtually every major world religion, there is the claim or the acknowledgement that it is the name of God, or the name of divine, of the divine, which is actually powerful. You find this in the Lotus Sutra in Buddhism. I mean, you find it certainly in Christianity, in the holy names, or there are holy name colleges in America, Catholic schools. And to give an example from Judaism, which I find remarkable, if you study in the Old Testament all the descriptions of the conceiving, the planning, the construction, the grand opening, and the remembering of the first temple in Jerusalem. Like whenever it talks about this first temple in Jerusalem, it's explained that this great temple is a temple to the name of God. That just as God lives in heaven, God, as his name, lives in the temple. It's a temple to the name. So, I don't want to leave anyone out, but certainly in the Sufi traditions of Islam, they're totally into this. So why? Yeah, you know, back around 2400 years ago, maybe 2370 years ago or something, Plato wrote a dialogue in which he posed this question. As I often explained, the Greeks were extremely ethnocentric. The Greek word for foreigner is also, of course, the Greek word for barbarian. So they really liked their Greek language, and Plato posed the question, is the Greek name for something, the Greek word for something, does it bear a special relationship to the object, like the Greek word for water? And of course, he was just thinking about it, but going beyond, let's say, that type of Hellenistic, whatever, focus, what is the status of language? Because if you think God is ultimately impersonal, there is no God, then language, which is such an intensely personal thing, and maybe language is an illusion. In fact, what you find is that practically all the traditions, philosophical traditions, that deny that God is a person, sooner or later run out of philosophical gas, and they say, we can't explain this in words. Words fail. And they sort of try to do language bashing. You know, language is limited, words are limiting. But is it? In the Vedic tradition, from the very beginning, the oldest Sanskrit work, and perhaps the oldest book in the world, the Rig Veda, their vach, or vak, which is our English vocal, voice, speech, is a goddess. There is a goddess of speech, and so language is divine. For example, there are cases where someone just speaking one or two words like I love you can absolutely transform your life if the right person says it. You know, it can completely transform your life. Transform your consciousness, your emotions, your whole everything. Language is very powerful. Because language is a meaningful vibration. And I mentioned this, I can't remember where I was anymore, maybe Tucson. A little while ago, and just I find it fascinating. I recently read a book on orality and literacy. In other words, for many thousands of years, human civilization went on, and there were a lot of very intelligent people, but they didn't write things down. And so it's like a whole different world to live in a world where everything is oral. It's like a whole different consciousness. And so one of the features is that language, speech, is a real object. It's a vibration out there in the world. And people understood that it, how powerful it is. And there is Shabda Brahma. There is spiritual vibration. That's the whole thing about mantra. The word mantra. That's what makes a powerful mantra powerful, is that speech can be spiritual, and therefore it can, in the case of God, God being absolute, the name and that which it names can be one, so that God can be fully present in the name of God. So when you chant, and this is totally non-sectarian, by the way. Any language, any tradition, your choice. You can redeem your Hare Krishna coupon in any religion or tradition. The idea is that, it's like, for example, let's say you're a mother or a father. If your child is crying out for you, you're not going to say, I'm sorry, Leroy, but you didn't pronounce my name properly, and so even though you're hungry and in danger, I'm not going to respond. I mean, it's not like that. If a parent, if a loving mother or father hears the cry of the child, it's like, who cares what it sounded like? The parent goes there. And so if anyone, in any language, in any tradition, or in no tradition, I mean, just anyone, cries out or calls out for God, and if you really mean, like, you know, the boss, you really mean the number one, then that sound that you made is a mantra. If you are crying out for God in any language, the sound you make is actually a spiritual sound. And that sound, and God is actually present in that sound. And so this was actually the whole idea behind yoga, because the word yoga, by the way, comes from the Sanskrit root yuj, and we still have that yuj in English in words like conjugal, which means like intimate connection, yoke as in to yoke two things together. That's the same yoke as yoga, not the egg thing, the connecting. So yoga means that we have to connect ourselves to God, and so As I've often said, you know, in America there's all these different detergents, you know, and when they're advertised, they all have some secret cleansing agent which begins with the letter X. And so the secret cleansing agent which will purify our consciousness is God, himself or herself or themselves. The idea is that if you bring your consciousness, it's like if your hands are dirty and you bring your hands into yoga, and that's the word you could use. If you create a yoga between your hands and water, you clean your hands. And some things are cleaned, like computer parts, with like air. You can sometimes air can clean things. And so what is it that cleans consciousness? What cleans consciousness is you can actually bring your consciousness directly into touch with the most pure object that exists, which is God. And so when you bring your consciousness directly into touch with God, that contact, that yoga, cleanses your consciousness, and your consciousness again becomes transparent, and you realize you are in this unimaginable wonderland, which is reality. And it expands forever, because God's consciousness is infinite, and as you become enlightened, you actually continue to experience the, I mean, I don't want to use the word orgasmic, but in other words, like this, when you become enlightened, you have this like overwhelming experience of like the supreme, oh my God, moment. And you actually have this continually, because there's no end to it. You never come to the end. Like let's say I have a relationship with someone, after a certain amount of time, well, they kind of know me and I kind of know them, and we kind of sort of settle in for the duration. But with God, because God is infinite, Krishna, you eternally will continually, you will continue to expand your consciousness forever. You will continue to experience greater and greater pleasure forever. Because you have found an infinite object for your consciousness. And an object which is not merely radiance or light or this or that, because what does that do for the musicality within us? What does that do for the humor within us, that we appreciate humor? What does that do for the part of us that loves nature? What does it do for the part of us that wants to feel a loving embrace? In other words, there's all kinds of parts of us, and all of them have to be infinitely engaged. It's not just one little aspect of us, but all of us as complete, pure, whole persons, we can connect fully with a personal absolute. So, for example, you can hear spiritual sounds and you engage your hearing. It's like the ear. This physical ear is not hearing. In Vedic philosophy, they make a distinction between a physical organ like the ear or the olfactory system, that what you call it, or the, you know, the eye system and all that. Because seeing is spiritual. The power of seeing is originally a spiritual power that you have as a soul. And when you come to this world and enter a virtual reality machine called a material body, then you see through physical eyes, or you hear through physical ears. But behind all of your physical senses, there is an original spiritual faculty of seeing, hearing, tasting, smelling, and so on. And you can actually engage these senses, spiritual senses, in a way that is beyond the body. In fact, all of our senses, and I'll just end with this interesting point I find interesting, is that all of our faculties, not our physical senses, but our original spiritual powers, ultimately are meant to perceive God. The idea that you can't see God is like, I mean, why rain on the parade like that? I mean, can you imagine? I mean, let's say you're a mother or father and you have a child, and then you leave a little note somewhere for the child. Sorry, but you will never see me. I just don't want you to see me. It's like, why would you? I mean, the greatest joy for parents is when the child really, you know, when your child's growing and comes to a point where the child really looks at you and you see the child really seeing you. I mean, what could be a greater pleasure for a mother or father than for your child to really see you and love you? So the idea of a creator who doesn't want to be seen, who's sort of like infinitely bashful or just pernicious or something, it's... Anyway, so our original spiritual faculties are meant to perceive the absolute truth. And since every one of us as an eternal being is part of that absolute truth, we're going to have a great time. So, those are some points there. Any questions on these points? Omkar, thank you for staying.
I was going to say thank you. I might have to go now,
Mark.
Thank you.
Oh, it was great. Great you came.
Yeah, it's a blessing. Thank you.
Don't
want to
stop
anyone.
No, everybody's. stop and stare at old car shares.
Okay,
yeah, I'll see you later. So, any questions?
Hey, well, what of the mind? It seems so obstinate. It seems so ridiculous sometimes. What of it?
Arjun asked that. Arjun says, a very interesting verse in chapter 6 of the Gita, Anicca Napi Varshneya Baladi Vanyajita. Well, he says, Atakina Prayukto Yam Papam Charati Purusha. Which means, by what? I'll translate very literally. Atakina Prayukto Yam. By what is a person engaged so that the person does the wrong thing? Anicca Napi Varshneya. Even not wanting to do the wrong thing, anicca, not desiring to do that. Baladiva niyojita, as if compelled by force. Because, as we all know, our behavior does not always perfectly tally or match up to our best, wisest understanding of life. I mean, all of us, it's not that we're always in our wisest state of mind, but we do have a wisest consciousness. And so our what we do and say doesn't always correspond to our deepest, best, wisest understanding, as we all know. And so that was Arjuna's question. Atakina, by what? There's even there's actually one of the Upanishads, these wisdom literatures, which is called the Kena Upanishad. They like, the by what Upanishad? Because Kena, the Upanishads have hilarious names. Like this ancient Sanskrit culture, and the Vedanta, of course, is trying to understand the Upanishads. Gave up on this one. So, Kena also means why, like by what or why. There's one Upanishad called the Shvetashvata Upanishad, the White Mule Upanishad, the Bald Man Upanishad. Anyway, so what Krishna answers is that kama esha krodha, it is actually kama, the word kama. Can be translated lust or simply selfish desire. There's a Kama Sutra. Sometimes the word is used to indicate sexuality, although that's not the root meaning of it. It simply means desire. So, and Kama and then Krodha, because in this world we have selfish desires, and because none of us is actually the center of reality. Therefore, our self-centered desires can never be fulfilled. I desire that another person mold their life to conform to my wishes. Like, you should live and breathe to please me. And that's love. And my love for you is that I will appreciate that. So therefore, the inevitable consequence of selfish desire is frustration. Because even if I fulfill a selfish desire for a time, inevitably, reality will impose itself. I saw this great bumper sticker years ago that said, it's like an environmental thing, it said, nature bats last. And you understand. So what we're seeing is that reality has this sort of nasty habit of imposing itself. So, if I have my self-centered desires, ultimately must be frustrated because I'm not the center. And because my desires are frustrated, I become angry. And then Krishna goes through the whole psychological process where through anger, I become deluded, because that's what anger does. It kind of deludes us. And we lose ourselves. We lose our self-awareness. Spiritual self-awareness. So it begins with this kama, self-centered desire. Interesting, like the word egoism in Greek, they have the same word in Sanskrit, the Sanskrit aham means I, and you change the H to a G, and it becomes ego. In Greek, aham, ego. So ahamkara is literally egoism. One little linguistic break, just to relax for a second, just take a second. It's interesting, if you study the history of languages, that a Sanskrit H tends to become a European G. And I gave one example, aham is ego. The H becomes a G, aham becomes ego. Another example is Volkswagen. Because the word Wagen In German, of course, means like a car, a wagon in English, and that's just Sanskrit Vahan. The H becomes a G, so Sanskrit Vahan becomes Vahan. And then there's, of course, a Magna Carta, the Sanskrit word Maha, like Mahabharata. H becomes a G, so you get Magna. And an interesting one is there's a Sanskrit word Huta, which means invoked. And so it means like a god that's invoked. And so if you change the H to a G, you get the German Gott, an English word God. So that's interesting. As you can see, Sanskrit is Indo-European, very much Indo-European language. So what were you saying? Oh, so your question, yeah, is the comma, the egoism, ahankar.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, this sense of ego, especially in the Vedas. It seems, from my perspective, that to destroy this ego, like, for example, my name is Andrew, I identify with what I do. I kind of, people ask, oh, who are you or what do you do? Well, I give them my activities. I'm a kayaker. I am a valet. I am this, I am that, but I'm like, with intelligence, I see, wait a second, that's what I'm doing. So then, who am I then? And then Andrew, I'm Andrew as long as this heart keeps beating. And as soon as the heart keeps beating, if we go on the philosophy that I continue, then was I ever Andrew? So then, if I'm not Andrew, then who am I? And so this sense of ego, maybe you could propound on this a little.
Well, sure. The false ego, or the ego in the pejorative sense of the word ego, I mean, as we know for Freud, ego is not a negative term. It just meant the I, the person. But so in the negative sense, ego, it means basically identifying with the body. So the body was named Andrew, and the body does the various things. Whereas I'm the eternal observer within the body. I'm also active. I don't mean to say we're condemned to eternally just, you know, watch someone else's movie or something. But we are active and dynamic. And we are using the body. For example, as we know, some people really... Well, there's an expression... how do they say it? I forgot. I remember the Spanish version. I can't remember the English version. Clothes don't make a man, that's the English version. It's funny, in Spanish, in Portuguese, they say the habit doesn't make the monk. But some people really identify with their clothes. I mean, think of this. It's a very obvious example. Some people really identify with their clothes. Like, I am what I'm wearing. And of course, where I come from in Los Angeles, you are what you drive. They even have this new version of, you know, Descartes, I think, therefore I am. So the new one is, I shop, therefore I am. So, as you know, some people really can identify with their cars, identify with their clothes. It's not just, I mean, identifying with your body rather than you inside the body is just the first stage of false ego. And then we keep going farther and farther away from our real self. Like, I'm not only the body, I'm the clothes on the body. I'm not only the clothes in the body, I'm the vehicle that the body and the clothes is sitting in and driving, or I'm my address. I have this prestigious address. I'm this neighborhood. I'm this house. I'm this, and so on. I'm, you know, this position, this executive position, or I'm.
Seems the essence of society right now is what you're speaking.
That's basically all that's going on down here.
Yeah.
So it's all about the body, and that's fine. I mean, the body is an invaluable, precious gift, because with this body, we can achieve enlightenment. We can perfect our lives. The body is the greatest gift that we could receive, because it's an instrument. It's a vehicle. So it would be rather like psychotic or really sick to think that anything which I am not, I destroy or I hate or I punish. I mean, that's really getting psychotic. So the fact that we are not the body in no way leads us to disrespect the body or not to value the body. It's just that we're not the body.
So sort of on that same line of thought. So it seems like the more we look at ourselves and people around us, and the more we shine this sort of transcendental light on human beings, everything sort of falls away. How do we define people? You know, we define people by their activities or by their, you know, physical appearance. Or the more we shine that light on there, we realize, okay, a person is not that. So then it leads me into this sort of confusing loop of, you know, in our tradition we say that there's the personality of Godhead. And so what then does that mean? If we say, you know, if we are a Satchitananda, then what does that mean to be a personality of Godhead?
Consider, to give a sort of a state up-to-date example, well, imagine a figure skating competition. Among all the finalists didn't sabotage each other. So imagine a figure skating competition, and let's say they're wearing tights or whatever, you know, whatever they wear, the different costumes. And the judges, perhaps except for their hands and their face, maybe their head, don't really see the bodies. You're just seeing the clothes. And yet it's obviously the bodies that are moving in those amazing ways, even though you're only seeing the covering. So even though we are acting through the body, it's still the soul acting in a sense. For example, let's say with genuine affection you embrace someone. In a sense, that's really you. It's the soul that loves and the soul that embraces. But now we're doing it through the body. And because we're doing it through the body, there's a penalty flag. Because, as we know, there's a certain what we call bodily chemistry. And so when one body kind of bumps into or sees another body, I'm like, that is exactly my type. You know, the face, the body, it's a match. Like the Terminator, you know, match. So, give me your body. And so, you know, when we get this match, then it arouses in us, it stimulates in us a desire to enjoy that other body. And so the desire to exploit, the desire to take, to use another soul is mundane. Whereas the soul is all about loving and giving. So let's say someone in this world, you know, loves someone, embraces that person they love. It is the soul. It is the soul acting, but it's impure. It's a little turbid, like say water. Let's say you have water which is impure, and therefore it's a little murky. It's not really completely transparent. But the water is still there. And the reason it flows and the reason it's semi-transparent is because it's water. And so we just have to purify it and sell it in plastic bottles. So if you consider like our consciousness now, if you consider our consciousness, when you love someone, when you embrace someone, that is you. The soul is affectionate. The soul loves. The soul expresses his or her love. But the problem is, just like water can be contaminated, that mixed with that genuine spiritual love, to give is a desire to take. So it's like going both ways. And real love means, so in a sense, let's say if you're attached to someone or you love someone, the problem is not that you love someone. That's not like illusion. Problem is, you don't love them enough. Because when we come to the point of pure love, there's no taking, there's only giving, and the other person is only giving to you. So everyone is giving to everyone, and no one is taking from anyone. So everyone is receiving everything. No one is taking, but everyone is receiving everything. So So in order to be spiritual, we have to actually become more romantic and really believe in true love and aspire for true, pure love. Any other question? If not, do you want to sing one more little song?
Yeah,
we'll do a little song. Yeah, and a musical note.
Sure.
Take the job to your guitar. You should play guitar.
Crank up the music machine. Here, why don't you give it a mic?
Jory has such a great voice.
I just talked to the chef who